From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Who is the real Madonna? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the pop star about how she created her sexy and controversial stage persona. And we'll talk about her current life as the mother of two, student of Kabbalah, and author of children's books. Her fourth has just been published. And we talk with actress Sandra Oh. She's one of the stars of the new film Sideways. She also co-starred in Under the Tuscan Sun and in the HBO series Arliss. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Hundreds of thousands of supporters of Ukrainian opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko are gathering in the center of the capital, Kyiv. They say they'll stay until Sunday's election is nullified because of vote fraud. NPR's Lawrence Sheets is at the scene among demonstrators of all kinds.
You see 80-year-old women who look like Ukrainian grandmothers from the countryside with gold teeth. You see old men on canes. You see people who are workers. You see people who look like they're professionals, who have suits and glasses on and that sort of thing. You see people with their kids. It's people from all walks of life.
International election observers have said they saw widespread fraud, including multiple voting by supporters of Ukraine's prime minister. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is denying that he worked behind the scenes to prevent an intelligence reform package from passing Congress. He was reacting to a New York Times editorial and to some lawmakers' claims that the Pentagon opposed the bill because it meant a loss of power over some defense intelligence activities.
The New York Times is wrong. The congressman who were saying that I had blatant opposition to the bill is incorrect because the bill didn't exist in the form that it currently is, and the president didn't have a position on the bill at the times that I was briefing him.
Rumsfeld declined to say whether he actually supported the intelligence legislation that was blocked this weekend. In Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair's Labour government says it will focus on terrorism in its last parliamentary session before going to the polls. The message was contained in the Queen's speech. Larry Miller reports from London.
Amid centuries-old parliamentary pomp and tradition, the Queen announced a number of new anti-terrorism initiatives the government intends to introduce, but she gave few details.
My government recognizes that we live in a time of global uncertainty, with an increased threat from international terrorism and organized crime.
The Queen said there will be legislation to increase security for all. Among the proposals will be trials without juries, identity cards, and expanded wiretaps. Even before the speech, Home Secretary David Blunkett said the new measures would affect people's civil liberties. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Federal agriculture officials say more sophisticated testing has ruled out mad cow disease in an animal that was suspected of carrying the disease. Officials said the second round of testing came up negative. The animal became a subject of concern after two preliminary tests at a slaughterhouse came out positive for the disease. Agriculture officials say the animal's meat never got into the nation's food supply. In stocks, the Dow gained 3 points to close at 10,492 in active trading. The Nasdaq was down a fraction to 2084. This is NPR News. The National Basketball Players Association's union is calling for an arbitrator to review the suspensions given to three Indiana Pacers players who were involved in a fight with fans in Detroit. The union says that the suspensions were too long, especially that given to Ron Artest, who is out for the remainder of the season. The FCC has announced a consent decree to settle outstanding complaints of indecency against media giant Viacom. NPR's Felix Contreras reports.
Viacom will pay $3.5 million to bring to a close 50 investigations being conducted by the FCC, as well as five incidents that had already been deemed indecent. Today's action is in addition to Viacom's forfeiture of over $300,000 for last year's Super Bowl wardrobe incident. Viacom has also agreed to adopt a compliance plan to prevent future violations. The plan will include the use of delay equipment during live broadcasts and the training of employees regarding FCC indecency laws. Viacom's media holdings include the CBS radio and television networks, the UPN network, and Infinity Radio. According to the FCC, today's decision is the largest settlement for multiple cases of indecency and reflects the seriousness of the commission to resolve all such complaints. Felix Contreras, NPR News, Washington.
Court documents filed today in Wisconsin show that the man suspected of killing six fellow deer hunters told investigators that he was fired on first. The suspect, 36-year-old Chai Vang, is a Hmong immigrant who lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. Witnesses say the confrontation began after Vang was found in a tree stand on private property and was ordered to leave by the property owner. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo USA, embracing the diversity of more than 100,000 employees across America and the people they serve. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After becoming one of the most controversial pop icons of her generation, selling close to 200 million albums around the world, Madonna is now writing children's books. We're going to talk with her about her children's books and how she created her stage persona, but let's start with her first number one hit recorded in 1984. Madonna's latest album, American Life, was released in April of 2003. Since then, she's published four children's books in a projected series of five. Each is set in a different time and place and is drawn by different artists. The new book is called The Adventures of Abdi. The readership of her children's books includes her own two children. Well, Madonna, welcome to Fresh Air. Why don't you read the opening of your new children's book?
Okay. Long ago, in a land far away from the one we know, where sand and mountains stretched as far as the eye could see, and snake charmers wandered the streets, there lived a little boy named Abdi. Abdi was an orphan who was looked after by an old family friend named Eli, who owned a jewelry shop. Eli was no ordinary jeweler. People came to him from near and far to have their precious gems made into exquisite necklaces, rings, and bracelets. It was said that Eli possessed magical powers, since every person who purchased or was given one of his unique ornaments was blessed with good fortune.
The story goes on to be a lot about magic, about certainty, mm-hmm. and about a belief that whatever happens to you is the best thing that could happen.
Yes.
And one of the lines in the book is, without certainty, we can accomplish nothing.
Exactly.
And that's a line that has a lot of different interpretations, because it's important to be certain and confident. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, certainty can really be a very misleading thing, because you could be certain and you can be wrong.
Yes, but that's okay too. It's okay to be wrong. I mean, that's how we learn our mistakes. I mean, you can, you know, it's better to be on the fast road to hell than the slow road to hell, because it'll just take you forever to get there. And it implies, you know, certainty implies that, you know, you have made a commitment. And if you realize it's best to get to the idea that you've made a mistake quicker rather than slower. So I disagree with you.
Your first children's book, The English Roses, was about mm-hmm. a group of girls who shun another girl out of jealousy, because this other mm-hmm. girl, she's beautiful, she's virtuous, mm-hmm. and they're so envious, mm-hmm. they kind of share this dream that they've traded places with her, mm-hmm. and they learn that her life is actually really difficult. She has no mother, she has mm-hmm. to cook and clean, mm-hmm. she's almost treated like Cinderella on a bad
right.
day.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was interesting that you made the girl who's left out because she's beautiful, as opposed mm-hmm. to left out because she's the ugly duckling.
Right. Well, I think at the end of the day, you know, it's a lesson about how we always judge people by how they look. And we are equally as judgmental of people who are good looking as we are of people who aren't good looking. I mean, you know, how many times have people made the assumption that someone's really beautiful is stupid? You know what I mean? Or someone who is really beautiful has everything that they could ever want in life, and they must be the happiest person on the planet. I mean, people always equate beauty with perfection, and it you know, that couldn't be more wrong. That's really the message of that book, that we cannot judge people by what we see.
Do you feel that judgment was ever made against you?
It continues to be made against me, but I think it, you know, I think we all suffer it. It's not just made against me because I happen to be a public figure or famous. I think each and every one of us are tricked by our eyes. And I misjudge people by what I see as well.
How did you start writing children's books?
I started writing children's books because I had a teacher, I still have a teacher that I study Kabbalah with, and he had suggested to me that I write them. I think one of the things that I think I was sitting around complaining about something, to tell you the truth, and he said, you know what? You really don't have any business complaining about anything. Why don't you do something to help other people? And I said, you know what? You're right. That's really embarrassing. And I'd learned so much from studying with him over the years that I decided what I would do was write children's books and encompass the things that I had learned in stories for children, stories that children could understand. And because I have children, I could see very clearly that, you know, bad behavior and bad habits start when people are really young. So why not, like, try to, like, nip that in the bud when you can?
Now, your music has been in part about defying convention and, mm-hmm. and also about being very overtly sexual. Do you feel like you have become a different person, or that you're just drawing on two different parts of yourself now, the more, like, sexual part and also the kind of children's author parent part? Are those two separate parts of you, or do you feel like you're moving beyond the earlier?
I think that I've changed and evolved as a person. I'm, you know, when I was exploring sexuality and being sexually provocative, it was a very different time in my life. I wasn't married. I didn't have children. But beyond that, I really wasn't thinking about I wasn't thinking in the big picture, you know, whether what I was doing was actually, you know, meaningful or helping people. And maybe in the long run, it was helpful. But I think my desires came from a much more selfish point of view. And I think that I have a different opinion about life and what my job is as an entertainer. And that is something that is a bit more helpful to humanity. And at this point in my life, I'm more interested in, you know, coming up with solutions to problems rather than just provoking people for the sake of provoking them. That is not to say that I have become a righteous person, that I don't make mistakes. And, you know, I'm still, you know, I consider myself a sexual person. I'm just not, you know, I'm not working out, like, my confusion about my own sexuality publicly. And that's really what it boils down to. And I sort of have a different point of view about sex now than I did then. So, It's kind of everything, and it's kind of everything that you mentioned. You know, that was an old part of me, and I am, you know, I'm looking at my place in the world differently than I was 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Do you feel like your earlier music was about working out publicly your confusion about your own sexuality?
Some of my music was. I mean, not all of my music. Some of my music was, some of my interviews were, the photo shoots I did, the book that I released. I mean, there's, you know, it kind of came out in everything that I was doing. And it didn't start off that way. That's certainly not how I started off, but it was my blue period.
what do you think of as the confusion? What do you think the confusion was about? Was it a straight or gay kind of confusion, or?
Oh, no, not at all. Uh-huh. I think I was raised in a very kind of conservative household, where, you know, the idea was, you know, my father didn't go around telling my brothers they had to be virgins when they were married. He just told my sisters and me. And I kept thinking, well, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this picture. How come my brothers don't have to restrict themselves sexually, but we do? And there seemed to be a lot of, you know, restrictions put on women when it came to sexuality and none on men. And as I, you know, became more famous and started to see what people were writing about me, I noticed that people were writing and making comments about the way I looked, and then I would compare it to, you know, what they would write about men, and they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't comment so much about the way a man looked. And then I also noticed that if you were perceived as being sexy or attractive or pretty, you pretty much were sort of, the idea that you had something of value to say was also taken away from you. And so I think I kind of got angry and reactive about all of that. And I decided to, like, sort of take it all the way over the edge and say, well, wait a minute, that's not true. You can actually be very sexual and very intelligent at the same time. And watch this, and here I'm going to do it. And not only that, but, you know, there's more to life than, you know, the male, you know, turning a female into an object, a sex object. I'm going to turn myself into a sex object. You know what I mean? I was just playing with convention and sexuality and trying to see what the boundaries were. And, you know, I was kind of trying to work it out, in, not only in my own head, but trying to understand, you know, why men and women were perceived differently and treated differently, only to realize and understand now that, in fact, women and men are different. And that's all there is to it. You know, male energy and female energy is indeed very different. And that is why, on a very primal level, we have the reactions that we do. So it was a sociological study for me.
Were you ever shy or self-conscious about your body?
Yes, I continue to be shy and self-conscious about my body. That is like that's the paradox of me.
I'm surprised to hear that. I thought you were going to say, are you kidding? Of course not.
No. Right. Well, no, I think I've always felt awkward about my body since I was a child. I was kind of chubby and overweight when I was younger. And, you know, I wasn't popular at all. I'd never had a boyfriend in high school. Well, I did have one boyfriend, but he was like the weirdest person in the school. And I think when I even when I became a dancer, And I started to lose weight and get thin, you know, and then I felt like people started to notice me and like me more because I was thin, which is just hideous and ridiculous. But that is the way we are. And then I stopped dancing, and then I kind of got chubby again, and that's when I was a performer, and everybody kept making remarks about how chubby I was, and that sort of irritated me. And so I felt like my body was always being, you know, criticized or pointed out, and I felt actually very self-conscious all my life about it. And I think part of my own kind of private and public sexual revolution was me saying, okay, I don't want to be ashamed of my body. So, but I still struggle with it. And, you know, after you have two children, you become like obsessed with like not having a flat stomach anymore.
My guest is Madonna. She's just published her fourth children's book. It's called The Adventures of Abdi. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Madonna, and she's just published her fourth children's book, and it's called The Adventures of Abdi. You were brought up in the church.
Yes, I was. Roman Catholic.
And did you ever feel that in your soul? I mean, did you ever really respond to the church, or were you always just like performing a responsibility by going?
But it's hard to say, did you ever feel, because as you know, as in the Roman Catholic Church, doesn't really explain anything to you. You are essentially taught to do things because that's what the Pope decrees, and that's what tradition will have you do, and that's what your family's been doing over the ages, and that's what you do. And so you can't help but look at it any other way than it's a responsibility, because it doesn't seem to be founded in anything except, you know, this is the way my family used to do it, or this is the way my ancestors used to do it. And it's only natural to gravitate away from that if people don't have answers. I mean, my father used to say to me all the time, you know, you can't wear pants to church. And I'd say, why? And he'd say, because you can't. Because I said so. Because it isn't done. And that was that. Those answers were just never good enough for me. And I find that that's true of religion in general, that no one really seems to have answers. And that's really why I moved away from the church, and that's really why I studied Kabbalah, because there are answers. And in fact, you know, a Kabbalist learns from day one that you have to ask why, and you must ask any question that you have and not stop asking until you get answers. So,
was there a sense of power that you got by using some religious some Catholic iconography in your work and subverting it? I mean, did that have a lot of power because you were brought up in the church?
I think so. I think, you know, the crucifix is a symbol of suffering and being a martyr, and maybe somehow I subconsciously thought of myself as that. So I think that was part of it. And also just the idea that I was being sexually provocative and using, a symbol of moral repression, you know, at the same time. It was just, you know, it was a very provocative combination. And I knew it would piss my father off. So that's the main thing.
That was a good thing.
Yeah. Well, that's what you got to do when you have 8 brothers and sisters. Got to do really provocative things to get your dad's attention.
Now, you mentioned before that, you know, as I think all your fans know, that you're studying Kabbalah now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you said that, I think through that you've learned a little bit about differences between male and female energy or between mm-hmm. men and women. What have you mm-hmm. come to see as essential differences between men and women now?
I think that women are naturally, they're naturally more giving, they're naturally more generous. And they have the ability to see things in a prophetic way, and whereas men can't. Men are much more informed by the mechanics of things, and by the surface of things. They're much more visually oriented. You know, I mean, I don't want to get into like, oh, women are better at this or men are better at that, because men are very good at some things that women aren't, and men and women are, and vice versa. I do think that. Because women are naturally more compassionate and more generous, you know, we have a tendency to want to resolve conflicts without fighting and without confrontation, whereas men aren't.
Ergo
the war in Iraq. So.
Is studying Kabbalah a sign that you've become Jewish, or is it just study
please,
of Kabbalah?
Don't make me sick. I'm never going to be Jewish, and I hate that phrase. And I have not converted to Judaism, and I'm not a member of any religion. I just makes me sick when people say that all the time, because nobody actually bothers to do the research to find out what it actually is. It's not religion. It's a belief system that's been around, a philosophy or a body of wisdom that's been around for thousands of years, and it predates religion. And in fact, a lot of religious beliefs get their ideas from the Kabbalah. But a lot of scientists get their ideas from the Kabbalah, like Isaac Newton, and Greek philosophers like Plato, and Thales, or Thales, I don't know how you pronounce his name. I think that science, religion, philosophy, even Shakespeare has at one time or another drawn from the wisdom of Kabbalah. Even Jung, if you study Jung, he studied Kabbalah for a very long time. It's actually quite fascinating and amazing to realize how many people were actually studying Kabbalah over the last 1,000 years or couple of 1,000 years. And we also believe that Jesus was a Kabbalist. So, because Jesus' message is essentially the message of the Kabbalah, love your neighbor as yourself, is see the world as unified, see the world as one. And that's what a Kabbalist believes. And so your whole life and all the decisions that you make and all your actions are meant to bring you closer to that idea, or promote that idea through your work, that we are, you know, there is no fragmentation. Religion fragments people, and Kabbalah
unifies people.
So just to clarify so that our listeners understand, when I asked you if this meant that you were turning to Judaism and you said that makes me sick, you didn't mean that Judaism of all the religions makes you sick.
No.
You mean the idea of turning to any religion.
I don't want to convert to any religion.
I just wanted to make sure that was clear to...
No, I mean, no, but the reason it makes me sick is because I hear a lot of people in, rabbis and religious Jews, I hear a lot of people say, oh, you know, she shouldn't be dabbling in the Kabbalah, or they think that I've converted to Judaism or this, that, and the other, they couldn't be further away from the truth. I was raised a Catholic and I've had enough of religion. And, you know, I don't want to judge other people for their religious beliefs, you know, whatever works for you, but as long as it is working for you. Once you join a group that says, you know, we're better than you because we're in this group, then that's something I'm not interested in. Unfortunately, most people that are part of a religious group do think that. They think if you're not Christian, that you're going to go to hell when you die. Or if you're not Jewish and you're not the chosen person, you know, part of the chosen people, quote unquote, then, you know, tough luck for you. I mean, I don't, Kabbalists, and I include myself in that group of people, do not look at the world in that fragmented sort of way. And I think it's rather impossible to say, I'm religious, but I want to unite the world. It's a major paradox.
Madonna has just published her fourth children's book. It's called The Adventures of Abdi. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
When I was very young, nothing really mattered to me but making myself happy. The only one. Now that I am grown, everything's changed. I'll never be the same because of you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by National Geographic, publisher of the new 8th edition World Atlas, with 17,000 updates on our constantly changing world, available wherever books are sold, and from Alfred A. Knopf, publisher of His Excellency George Washington by Joseph J. Ellis, author of Founding Brothers. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Life is a mystery. Everyone must stand alone. I hear you call my name, and it feels like home.
Coming up, more with Madonna, and we talk with Sandra Oh, one of the stars of the new film Sideways.
Joy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Madonna. She's just written the fourth in a series of five children's books. The latest is called The Adventures of Abdi. You're writing children's books now. What books or movies or music did you really care about when you were the age of your daughter, which is, what, eight? She's around eight now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't really see movies when I was eight. I had a very big appetite for reading, and that was really my escape. And I mean, I read all kinds of books. Do you want to know, like, which particular books?
Sure.
Or,
yeah.
I mean, I loved the C.S. Lewis, The Chronicles of Narnia, Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass, Charlotte's Web, The Little Prince, just escaping to other worlds, you know. But I love to read, always.
What about music? When did that enter your life in a meaningful way?
Music entered my life in a meaningful way when I started dancing, when I started studying ballet, and that was classical music. So that was really what I got, you know, interested in first, classical music, Mozart and Chopin and Bach and Vivaldi and so on and so forth.
And
I wasn't really interested in pop music until I moved to New York, to tell you the truth. I mean, I did, I won't lie, I did see a few concerts when I was in high school before I moved to New York. I saw David Bowie, and that was kind of a life-changing experience for me. I just thought he was the most amazing creature I'd ever seen. And I thought, you know, he really pushed the envelope, and he was confusing to me because I couldn't understand. He was so androgynous, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And his music was amazing. And so that made a huge impact on me. But I didn't really buy records when I was little. I just didn't do it. And I didn't really think about becoming a singer or writing music or doing what I do now until I quit dancing.
Now, your music first caught on as dance music in the clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Were you going to the clubs to dance?
Yep, that's the only thing I did. I never drank, took drugs or anything. I just would go to a disco and dance for 6 hours, like some weird whirling dervish.
did you dance dances that you would just kind of improvise?
Yeah.
Or were there certain dances of the time that you were doing?
No, I just improvised. And nobody danced with me because I think I was a bit too wild.
So you just danced yourself on the floor?
Yeah, it was a little bit pathetic. I just went out and danced. Sometimes girls threw drinks on me and stuff, I remember.
Why?
I don't know. I'm not really sure. Mean girls and discos. You know, see, it just sort of kept repeating that theme. I had mean girls picking on me in school, and then, you know.
The early work that you did as a performer was the kind of thing that some parents would have liked to hide from their children because it was so overtly unconventional and sexual.
Mm-hmm.
Your children now are, what, eight and five?
Four.
Four.
Mm-hmm.
So do you ever feel like there's pop culture you need to hide from them?
Yes, I do, in fact.
What do you hide
from
them?
Well, my children don't watch TV, period.
Really?
Yeah. So that's it. They can watch films, but I choose the films. So, and yes, I do, to a certain extent, keep things from my children because look, I didn't grow up watching television, and...
You didn't?
No.
You weren't allowed to?
Mm-mm. Because my father wanted us to use our imagination, and look, it really paid off, didn't it? So, I mean, that's the main reason they don't watch TV, because I want them to use their brains. I don't want them to sit in front of a box and get entertained and, like, turn into vegetables. So, they just read all the time.
And what are you going to do, like, when they get a little bit older and they start going to their friends' houses and watching TV there?
Well, I can't stop that. My daughter's pretty good about telling people she just doesn't watch TV. I mean, so she watches films, and she always asks me if she can watch the film she's going to watch. So, you know, I can't shield her from everything. But what I can do is try to stress what is important in life, and that is not the surface of things. And I figure the more I congratulate and encourage her to do things and that have to do with working on the inside of her and the way she, you know, acknowledge that the way she treats people is more important than the way she looks, that, you know, she will in time also not be affected by so much by the surface of things.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like in finding an image for yourself as a mother and a children's book author and Kabbalist, that you've had to kind of figure out what the image is in the same way you had to maybe figure out the image when you became a pop star. In other words, did you have to construct it in a way?
Are you asking me if I've discovered who I am as I've explored my work? Did I find myself while going through the different phases of creativity and expressions?
I guess I'm partially asking if you feel you found yourself, and if in finding yourself, this is who you found, or if you feel that there's an element of life that is theater, and that even who you are now has a theatrical element to it.
I think that art imitates life and life imitates art. And I think that, you know, very personal things have happened to me over the years, and I've chose to, you know, explore that in my work. And then I've had, you know, experiences in my work that somehow I've, you know, found resonating in my personal life. And I just think that there's like a reciprocation there. And I think that, you know, I can absolutely differentiate. You know, there's the me that, you know, goes to work and explores and works very hard and has lots of collaborations with lots of creative people. And I go on stage and I entertain 20,000 people, and then I go home. And then there's the me that makes the bed and washes the dishes and changes the diapers and, you know, does things that are actually, you know, quite simple and not associated at all with theater. So I see the things I do as my job, and I see my life with my family and my children and my friends as really the most important aspect of my life, but it also informs my job.
Well, listen, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Madonna has just written her fourth children's book. It's called The Adventures of Abdi.
Turn to stone.
Coming up, actress Sandra Oh. She co-stars in the new film Sideways. This is Fresh Air. Sandra Oh is one of the stars of the new movie Sideways. She also co-starred in Under the Tuscan Sun in the HBO series Arliss. She played the sports agent's assistant. In the film Double Happiness, she starred as a young Chinese-Canadian woman who wants to act but faces two big obstacles: parents who don't want her to act, and an industry that stereotypes Asian women. Sandra Oh grew up in Ottawa. Her parents are from Korea. Let's start with a scene from Sideways. The story is about two men nearing middle age. Thomas Hayden Church plays an actor who used to be in a soap opera. He's about to get married, but before he does, he's going to take a road trip through wine country with his old college roommate, played by Paul Giamatti. He's a teacher who has written a novel he's hoping to get published. The actor is all ego and id. The teacher is insecure and self-conscious. Sandra Oh plays a pourer at a vineyard who begins a passionate affair with the actor. He has conveniently neglected to mention he's about to get married. This is the scene where the guys first meet Sandra Oh at the vineyard.
So what do you think?
Quaffable, but far from transcendent.
I like it. It's great. Oh.
Cabernet Franc. This is only the fifth year we've made this varietal. Very few wineries around here do a straight Cab Franc. It's from our vineyards up in Santa Maria. And it was a silver medal winner at Paso Robles last year.
Mm. Mm. Well,
I will tell you something. I've come never to expect greatness from a cab, Frank, and this one is no different. It's kind of a hollow, flabby, overripe.
I don't know. Tastes pretty good to me. So, do you live around here, Stephanie?
Yeah, up around Los Alamos. And I agree with you about Cab Franc.
We're just over in Buellton, the Windmill Inn.
Oh, yeah?
Do you happen to know a gal named Maya that works at the Itchy
Yeah, House? Sure. Yeah, I know Maya.
Yeah? Oh, we had a drink with her last night. Miles knows her.
Yes. Can we move on to the Syrah, please?
Jumping at the bit, huh?
Sandra Oh, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you are directed by your husband, Alexander Payne, in this movie, who also made About Schmidt and An Election. Sometimes working with a spouse can be very awkward. For example, sometimes couples have a way of communicating that's with each other, especially when they're at home alone, that's different from the way they communicate in public. And sometimes people are different as a couple than they are as individuals on their own. And so if you're working together with your other half in that couple in a kind of public situation because you have other actors on the set and camera crew and all that stuff, in your instance, did it ever get awkward because there's like the private version of the couple and the public version of the couple and sometimes, you know, the two cross in an uncomfortable way?
Alexander has worked with a lot of the same crew for almost all four films. And I know a lot of the crew very, very well. And I can't express to you enough what a family kind of atmosphere the set was. It was really an extraordinary experience. And I've hung out with so many of those people for a long time that our persona as a couple is very, very comfortable. But when it actually came to the direction and the work of it, as opposed to hanging out and just the atmosphere of it, the first couple of days I was extremely nervous. And the difficulty is that, you know, you're nervous or you're feeling insecure, as all actors do. The person who knows you the best and who can read you the best just happens to be the person who is giving you direction. So, you know, when my deep insecurity would come up, you know, no one would be able to sense it except for my husband. And so, you know, he'd be going, "Oh, honey, are you okay? What's going on?" And I would go, no, nothing. It's fine because it's really about you, you know. So we actually came up with after the first day we were driving back home, and because we talk about work a lot, we're not one of those couples who kind of don't bring work into our lives. You know, when I'm doing a project, I talk about it. When he's doing a project, he talks about it. When we were driving home, suddenly he kind of started talking in a way that we always talk, and it just happened to be putting himself in the third person. And it was great because he said, you know, "Honey, did the director maybe say something wrong? Was there something the director, you know, did?" And I'm like, no, it wasn't really about the director, because that's how I usually talk. You know, it's like, "Oh, I had this experience with this director." And after we kind of found that way, which was to talk about ourselves in the third person, it didn't become kind of a personal thing. It became a very, very normal, "This is how we talk every day."
Sideways is based on a novel. So, you know, the story was already written before it was cast. When you were cast as the woman who becomes the girlfriend of the actor who's about to get married, did the role change at all because you're Asian? Well,
no.
let me give you an example. Yeah, the character's mother is white.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, that implies something.
It's really great to be able to speak to the writer director every day. Yeah, it really does give you an in. So when, you know, he was thinking about the mother, and I remember we were in like a hotel somewhere, and he goes, "Oh, honey, who do you think you should play your mom?" I thought, I want to pack as much story about Stephanie, the character, in this film as possible. My character is actually not on screen very much and doesn't have a lot of dialogue. So she's there visually a lot. So I was very, very conscious to try and pack as much character into every moment as possible, you know, visually, hair and costume and the way I walk, the way I ate French fries. As well, with this opportunity, with an in to make suggestions of what my daughter would look like and what my mother would look like, I tried to make big choices. So I am Asian. The wonderful little girl who played my daughter is half Korean and half black. And the woman who played my mother is white. And it's never talked about in the film. It's never dealt with. It's a very just a short scene where it's a visual thing. But I think it's strong because you get from it, it tells a deeper story about Stephanie. So I guess that kind of answers your question. Is I wanted to make the suggestion of the casting as to be as richly reflective of Stephanie's character as possible.
Now, you grew up in Ottawa, in Canada. Your parents, I think, came to Canada from Korea. Is that right?
Yes. They came actually to the States in the early 60s, and then they moved to Canada.
Now, you started working professionally at the age of 16, and I think you did TV, theater, and commercials.
Yeah.
Did your parents push you in this direction at all? Because often when people get started young, it's this is a no.
Oh, God,
no. This is a no, right.
Oh, my goodness. No. 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 Absolutely not. We've come a long way, my parents, and we've come a long, long way. It was they definitely did not expect me to be an actor, and early on did not want me to be an actor for a lot of very, very good reasons. But, you know, sometimes you're born without a choice. You know, you have to become who you have to become, you know, who you know you have to become. And that was the case for me. You know, it was great in Ottawa, you know, because it's a bilingual town, it's a bilingual country, and I speak French. You know, there were a lot of little industrial films and little television shows and stuff like that. So I was able to get in there by, you know, doing the English version and the French version. So as I started with that and, you know, made a little pocket change here and there, my parents just thought it was a hobby. And as long as I kept my academics up, which I did, it was no real problem to them because, you know, they were patient with this growing phase that I was going through. But as, you know, as high school was ending and it became much more of a serious thing for me, there was, you know, it was like war at home.
Over your future?
Yeah, over my future. And ultimately, you know, I'm the only person in my family who doesn't have a master's degree. You know, I never went to college. I'm like the dumb one, you know. But I will say that every single roadblock that my parents put in front of me has only made me better, has only made me, like, I get to talk to you now. Do you know what I mean? I'm talking to Terry Gross. And somewhere along the line, it's because my parents said no.
Well, what were some of the barriers they put up and some of the things they said no about?
They're just, like, really, and also I have to make clear that they are so amazingly supportive now, because they now see the worth and meaning to what I do. My parents really instilled in us that whatever you do in life, it should be for society and it should have meaning. And for them, you know, film and television acting seemed to be a meaningless job. That and the inevitability, because they faced it their entire life, which is you don't look like everyone else. I don't, ultimately their feeling was, I don't want to put my child in a place where she's going to be rejected and hurt. You know, I was a very sensitive kid, right? And so they did not want me to do that. Because they said that I couldn't do it and I did it anyway, really no one else can hurt me. Do you know what I mean? Like, my parents, I mean, I'm really, really lucky. I've come from a really fantastic family, and we're really close. So the people who are the most important to you, putting up the largest roadblocks, and for me to be able to overcome it and then win them over, you know, I did this piece when I was, my very, very first thing I did out of the National Theater School was this piece called, for the CBC, called The Diary of Evelyn Lau. And to this date, it's the piece of work that I'm most proud of. It was a story based on this wonderful, famous Canadian poet, Evelyn Lau, and it traced her life between 14 and 17 when she ran away from home and ended up on the streets and became a prostitute and a drug addict. But she continued, her fire of being a poet continued her journey, and she basically got out of it. When my parents saw that film, because it was pretty harrowing, it kind of dawned on them, at least to my mother, which was really important for me, that what I was doing was meaningful. And that's when it started changing for them.
My guest is Sandra Oh. She co-stars in the new movie Sideways. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Sandra Oh is my guest, and she's now co-starring in the new movie Sideways, and she co-stars in a new TV series called Grey's Anatomy that will premiere on ABC in January. Sandra, have the roles that you have been offered over the years been limited at all, do you think, by the fact that you are of Korean descent?
That's such a big question.
Is it a hard one to figure out because you never really know for sure?
Yeah, because you never really know. Like, many people ask me, well, what's it like being an Asian actor? I'm like, well, geez, I don't know what it's like being white, so I only know what I know. And I have constantly, I'm knocking on wood, I have had the great fortune to continue work, and people who have responded to my work who let me work for them. If anything, as many people will know what I'm talking about when I say this, it's the glass ceiling is just lower, and it's a different kind of frustration than that all actors have. Because, you know, if you're an actor, you have the general frustration, which is, I know, you don't look right, you're not pretty enough, you're too tall, you're things that you cannot control. But on top of that is another layer that we all know is out there, which is in stories that people want to tell, being shut out of being the central storytellers is frustrating in a deeper way. And going back to your question, the ways that I felt it being difficult not being white is because you cannot get into the room of those primary storytellers, and that the films and the stories and the TV shows and all that stuff that are mostly being produced or produced and supported and usually seen by people, somehow they're not about you, or they're not letting you, because of what you look like, be who, you know, they want to represent their story. But, you know, in some ways, it's like it can create a great spirit in you if you don't let it crush you.
What do you mean?
I think it makes you stronger. Do you know what I mean? It makes you stronger, and it makes you more subversive. And ultimately, I think like-minded people will hopefully respond to your work, do you know what I mean, and want specifically what you have to offer.
In what way do you think it's made you more subversive?
I've been really, really fortunate. The majority of my work, I have played non-Asian-specific parts. Like this a TV show, The Grey's Anatomy. The character was like a small, pert blonde girl that was written in. And the creators responded to who I am. I mean, I feel like I'm subversive just by being on screen. Do you know what I mean? I'm not a typical, or I'm not... Actually, I shouldn't say I probably am very, very typical. I'm not the image of a lot of Asian women that people are used to seeing. I don't look like a Cupid doll, you know? And unfortunately, I mean, I don't look like Gong Li. Or, you know, I don't. And my voice is the way that it is. It's much lower. And so me just being cast and being on screen and saying the lines the way that I want to say it and projecting a different image of Asian women, I think is subversive.
Would Arliss be a good example of that, of a different image of an Asian woman?
Yeah, I think so, because like she was really, really funny and really, really crass. You know, in some ways, and
pushy sometimes too.
And pushy and like mean and selfish. And even though she was smart and wore glasses, she was incompetent in a lot of ways. And over the years, when people come up to me and say that how they respond to my work, it has to do with a different kind of image or a specificity that I am able to bring out. Do you know what I mean? That is not the same as everyone else.
Well, Sandra Oh, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Same here. Thank you, Terry, so much.
Sandra Oh co-stars in the new film Sideways, and she's one of the stars of the new ABC series Grey's Anatomy, which premieres in January. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Arista Records. Sarah McLachlan and her new CD and DVD set, Afterglow Live, features a new live concert and her latest video at all FYE locations. And from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, John Dominic Crossan, one of the leading scholars of the historical Jesus. His latest book offers a new interpretation of the life and writings of the Apostle Paul. Also, we remember Broadway composer Cy Coleman with an interview from the archive. He died last week. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.